All righty, we are live. I want to thank you, Sean, for coming on my podcast here. And so tell me about yourself. What do you do?
Sure.
What kind of interest do you have with Catholicism, with apologetics in particular?
Yeah, I guess start with a little bit of going back, further background. I'm cradle Catholic, born and raised. I'm originally from Massachusetts, went to Catholic school all my life there. I went to Syracuse University for my bachelor's in political science and history. And near the tail end of my time there, I joined the Knights of Columbus. We formed a Knights of Columbus Council at the Catholic Center at Syracuse. So joined up with that. I was getting involved. I was leading Bible study. And I was, simultaneously doing, I'd say from like 2006 or so onward, I'd been involved in online apologetics discussions, primarily on Facebook, and kind of kept up with my own personal study. After I finished up my undergrad, the priest, the chaplain at the Catholic Center at Syracuse, asked me to stay on as an assistant campus minister. And then at the end of the summer, when I came back to start the job, they'd actually let go the campus minister. So I got that job.
Bit of a
step up, right out of college, and I already got my own office. I did that for a year, leading Bible studies, leading RCIA, just involved with the liturgy and the social gatherings and so forth at the Catholic Center there. And I was studying poli-sci, and then I picked up history as well. And I also more academic interest in religion along the way. Of course, religion and history are very interrelated, obviously. When I finished up my time as a campus minister, I had applied for graduate school at the Catholic University of America. So I went there for my master's in church history, focusing in history of the early church, specifically Latin patristics. So what I'll joke with my friends is I had a bunch of friends who were studying philosophy at the time, who I was living with, and they would do things like bring up Thomas Aquinas, and I would be like, he's too new for me. Because I was more immersed in Cyprian, Augustine, and so forth. I kept the online apologetics going during this period of time, and then 2012 finished up there, and then I started tutoring, doing some other side gigs for cash, and then ended up as a long-term substitute at an all-girls Catholic high school from November to March, so almost a full year. And that was pretty rewarding.
So now we're getting it 2 years after you graduated college. Is that?
Yeah.
Am I following right? There.
Or after grad school, that is.
After grad school. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked that. I also spent 1 year as a DRE mixed in there, a director of religious education. And that was a valuable experience for a couple of reasons. One thing, I learned that administrative work is not really my thing. I don't want to so much be the manager telling other people what to do. I want to be one of the boots on the ground, one of the pair of boots on the ground, actually doing the thing in question. Because as I can recall, the times when a CCD teacher wouldn't show up and we didn't have anyone to fill in and I had to fill in, I was like, I enjoy this a lot more than managing all the teachers. I want to do the teaching. That's where my talents are. That's my shtick. So I want to stick with that. The school I'm at right now, I'm teaching middle school, Catholic middle school, social studies and religion, 6 classes a day, over 70 kids. And I've been doing that for the past 8 years. This would be year number 8. When I started, I was one of the newbies to the middle school teacher department. And now I'm the one who's out of the middle school crew. I'm the one who's been there the longest, which is, a lot different than being new to it. And you learn a lot of things along the way. It's, you know, you're not just educating the kids, you're educating yourself. They're educating you. Very eye-opening experience, very, you know, important experience for, you know, for me in my life. That has only enhanced, you know, my passion for apologetics, my passion for the history of the church, and for helping other people come closer to Christ. When it comes to apologetics, if I give some of my thoughts on that, I think solid apologetics doesn't water down the truth, but it also doesn't ignore the importance of prudence. You get some people that are extremely zealous and they just throw prudence out the window and it all becomes about triumphalism and egoism. And if you, like, even the truth can be something you're using to prop yourself up, you know, instead of propping God up, you know, elevating God to where God is supposed to be, or rather recognizing where God has elevated himself. So you got to be wary of pride. You also have to be wary of the types that want to water everything down in the hopes of just, you know, everyone holding hands and saying kumbaya, because there are certain, you know, proper ecumenism and proper apologetics, proper catechesis, it all has to do with, you know, telling the truth as it is, doing so in a prudent manner, but telling the truth and not watering it down in any way, not in any way trying to give people a conception that is less than what is actual. And so I think that that's pretty important too. So you have to navigate, not, you know, hammering people over the head versus being so timid that you're not actually conveying the fullness of the faith to them. And so I think that that's really important in apologetics. I think for anybody, especially people engaging in online apologetics, it can be very easy to kind of objectify and dehumanize the person on the other end. You know, because you're just seeing them through a screen. The times I've done like Zoom chats with people and so forth, those have actually been much better because I think it does add the human element a bit more.
Right.
Really helps with that. Helps keep us from objectifying one another and, you know, turning the other person into like a video game character that you have to defeat. So I think it's important, you know, anytime any of us start to feel like we're getting a little hot-headed and, you know, we're getting a little arrogant and we're kind of going after somebody instead of what they're saying, you know, that's when you should, you know, step away from the computer, go take a walk. And if you said anything that was problematic, you come back and you apologize later. You know, that could be more important for your witnessing to Christ than some argument you might make about, you know, faith and works or purgatory or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I say a lot that truth is communicative, right? Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. You might hear my son is kind of crying at the door. My wife's out there with him. So for anybody listening, that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. Nobody's
How old is he?
Getting hurt. He's about 16 months.
Yeah. That's a very exciting time. I'm sure he's
adorable. It really is. Yeah. He's walking a lot and he's, he's trying to start running basically. And,
So, my niece is 3. I'm not married. I don't have any kids, but my niece has turned 3 in January and she's just adorable, full of zest for life, always happy. I'm real absolute blessing to the family.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Okay. If you don't mind, how old are you?
Well, I hope my students aren't watching this because I always keep my age a closely guarded secret. And I make them, and they have to beat me in something in order to earn the secret. I'm 64 and I dye my hair. I'm 37, going on 38.
Okay. Cool. So you were born in like 86,
85?
85.
July 10th, 1985. Awesome. But don't ask me my blood type. I don't know that. I don't know.
Social security number? You got that? No. Cool. Okay. So you said when you went into graduate school, you studied Latin patristics. Your bachelor's degree was in political science and religion, you said?
Science and history for the bachelor. And then it was church history for the master's.
Wow. Okay. So has the political science really played in, or has most of your interest really just morphed into the religious history side of things?
You know, it has. Not in the way I might have initially anticipated. When I was in undergrad, I was probably a bit more kind of libertarian leaning. Okay. Not full blown, but I was kind of leaning in that direction. Like at the tail end of high school, my sister was in college. I'd like grabbed some of her pamphlets from like philosophy class she was doing or whatnot. And I was like reading John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and kind of delving into that. And I was really interested in history. And then I was also passionate about like justice and so forth. So like politics, like what should policy be? How are we going to live together in society? What laws are right and are wrong? Those are important considerations for me. And that never changed. My application of certain first principles and so forth did change. So I became, I think, as over time, as I became even more solid in my knowledge of my faith, I think I moved a little bit away from the libertarian angle. And that's not me saying like, you know, me trying to knock all libertarians or anything. I wasn't like a political party libertarian. I was more kind of philosophically libertarian. But and libertarianism on the whole, I'd be like, is incorrect. Similarly, utilitarianism is incorrect. I mean, I think certain political philosophies like that, just like other religions from a Catholic perspective, we would say, you know, they have some of the truth and they don't have all the truth. So I was able to like shave off the parts of, you know, my kind of libertarian perspective that didn't align with Catholic social teaching, you know, that you can't like align with rerum novarum and whatnot. And I was able to kind of trim those away and recognize that some of the starting assumptions of, you know, Enlightenment political philosophy, like, you know, man in the state of nature is just an atomistic, separated, totally alien individual to everybody else, and then he interacts with them, and then he creates society in order to deal with everybody else. That's not, you can't really reconcile that with the biblical narrative, and I really don't even think from a human anthropological angle you can kind of ultimately justify that. It's a little more fictitious. It's sure. Fairly consistent once you with those starting premises, but I don't accept the starting premises anymore. So like going forward, a lot of the stuff I learned in political science, how to debate, how to argue, how to analyze texts critically. A lot of that was very much still relevant. I mean, even things that are relevant, I took constitutional law classes, even things relevant to the constitutional interpretation, like original intent, original meaning, how do you interpret the Constitution and understand what it means? Those are still questions that, while slightly different in form, you know, those are types of questions that are relevant for biblical interpretation and patristic interpretation. So I can still use the lessons and the tools that I gained from all my experience and, you know, in the political science background. I'm just not as keen on, you know, ever running for office or anything along those lines. I think you have to be a certain type of person. You know, I don't mean a negative sense, but you just have to be a certain type of person to kind of delve into that arena. I think to a certain extent, you have to care more about a real politic, like practical approach when you're engaging in politics, just if you want to ever get anything done. My focus is more so on the truth, whether or not it's practical to apply it or not. So I'm more interested in, you know, I'd be more interested in a political science context to be like, well, how should we organize society? Not what can we do right now? So that was part of kind of what made me delve into more theoretical waters. When you're looking at history and saying, well, what should people have done? In context of why people were doing certain things. And when it comes to, you know, theology, it's at the end of the day, it's like, well, this is the truth. And you got tons of people who aren't, you know, living in accordance with the truth, you know, through their belief or through their actions. But at least you can talk and access the natural law through your reason and access, the divine law through revelation and, you know, kind of use that as then your starting point. And so I'm, you know, very interested in the intellectual, side of things in that regard. And so everything I learned in the past has definitely helped me in the present going forward.
Sure. Is there anything in philosophy or theology that you like to focus on in particular, or multiple things?
Well, it depends. I try not to overstep my qualification, only insofar like I'm not going to present myself as I am a philosopher. It was nice to be in a house of guys who were getting their, doctorates in philosophy, because, you could constantly bounce things off of them, and it was, an enriching experience. And I'm still friends with those people to this day. I try to do like a lot of, personal independent study, not super deep, but, I philosophy matters. And so, I want to delve into those waters, in particular, when you get to the subject of metaphysics and, the problem of universals, when you get into realism, when you get into nominalism, I'm fairly passionate about that, because I do find kind of the thesis that Reverend Louis Bouyer makes in The Spirit and Forms of Protestantism, that that nominalism is to a very large extent responsible for the Protestant Reformation and plays a role, not an exhaustive role, but definitely a strong contributing role in the development of the Protestant five solas, particularly sola fide, but also sola scriptura. That one took me a little bit longer to really see exactly how. I think Reverend Bouyer makes a good case, but more experience with various conversations with hundreds, thousands of people, caused me to make certain connections, and also looking a little bit more at the church fathers and how they were addressing like the nature of the text and how we understand what the text is saying and to what extent it's actually, the text is God's divine condescension. God's not speaking literal Hebrew and Greek words up in heaven that are then transcribed for us. These are all important considerations.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I think, so I didn't realize that it was Louis Bouyer, right? Or is this a different Bouyer? Yeah. So, cause he was the one that he was eventually, kind of thrown in with the modernists. Is that right?
And I know he was kind of horrified. I'm not too familiar with his personal history, like post that book. I know that I've read that book. I guess my attitude when it comes to authors, is kind of similar to my attitude when it comes to like, musicians, is I'm not necessarily a big fan of you. I might be a big fan of a particular work you've done. So depends.
Yeah. Cause I know that definitely that connection between nominalism and Protestantism, like I've read it in Leo XIII. I've read it in a number of other places as well. So it's a fascinating one.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think that's something to it. I think it was, Dr. Jordan Cooper touched upon it in one of his YouTube videos. I took a peek where he addressed that Luther did have some nominalism in his background, but then he brought up, the extent to which Luther didn't agree with the nominalist school. And that's a fair point to raise, but I don't think you can ultimately avoid the reality that it did influence the way he read the text, that it did influence the way he conceptualized God's law and what it means to break God's law and what it means to be right in God's sight. I think once that's going on, you're really stepping away from a more realist, like ontological conceptualization of what it means to be righteous, what it means to be just, what it simply means to be good. It seems to me you're kind of simultaneously jumping into voluntarist waters, where you're just grasping onto the first horn of the Euthyphro dilemma. I think you can see indications of this in both Luther and Calvin, not 100% consistent indications of this, but you can definitely see indications of it, that their emphasis on God's sovereignty kind of causes them to go that voluntarist, route, where the Euthyphro dilemma, of course, being, are things good just because God says so, in which case the danger is that it seems that like good and bad are just arbitrary, and God tomorrow could say that hugging a family member is evil and that murdering someone is good. And that seems very problematic. And then on the other hand, you have the second horn of the Euthyphro dilemma, which is, that things are good, therefore God says that they are good or bad. Things are good or bad, God, therefore God says so. That's more reflective on God's part, and it seems to posit a moral law, transcendent moral law that's preceding God, and it takes away from God's sovereignty, which we obviously don't want to do. I feel like the classical Christian answer to this, the classical Catholic answer to this, and I'm not excluding the reality that there are many Protestants who also accept this synthesis. At least if we had this conversation, they'd be like, yeah, I totally agree with you on this point, which would be that God's law and what's right and what's wrong and so forth is ultimately based on God's nature. So it's not based on something that's preceding God. So God's sovereignty is maintained, but it's also not completely ad hoc. It's not arbitrary and flimsy in the way that it could just be something else tomorrow. That synthesis, that way of saying, hey, the Euthyphro dilemma, it's a false dilemma. You know, it's a false dichotomy, and we want to avoid that. I think Catholicism does a very good job of avoiding that, whereas I think to a certain extent, I'm not confident that the Protestant reformers avoided that, because I think they're just indications that they veered too much on the voluntarist side, just as they veered too much on the nominalist side. And I think part of that, it stems from a kind of a nominalist approach and a voluntarist approach to the text itself, like as a starting point, taking, you know, anthropomorphisms about God and being like, well, if you don't take this univocally, if you don't take this as meaning the same thing about God that it would mean about us, then you're just committing eisegesis. You're reading into the text instead of out of the text. When you look at church history, it is the case that, you know, other heretical groups have kind of made that line of argumentation before. The Arians, in response to the Nicaeans, would be like, well, it says begot, and what does beget mean? What did everyone believe that beget or, you know, begotten meant in fourth century Christianity? Something didn't exist and came to exist. So you can understand how the Arians could point to, you know, the lexicon, meaning just like, and for them, it was just like the way this word is used. They could point to that for certain terminology, the same way Protestants, since the reformers on, would just be like, well, let's look at our lexicon, dicaio. Yep. It means to declare righteous. So all God's doing is an extrinsic declaration. Well, what else are we going to end up doing with that? I feel like if we're going to be consistent with that, we have to take a number of particular interpretations of the Old Testament and the New Testament that we probably don't want to take. That I feel like the more sophisticated Protestants would agree that we shouldn't take. Like, are we going to go to Genesis 1 and where God says, let there be light, and then it says, and there was light? Are we going to say that God declared in, you know, pre-creation Hebrew that he's saying, let there be light, and, you know, up in the heavens, and that's the declaration, right? That's analogous to justification. And then him actually making the light is him actually doing something, and that's analogous to sanctification. Right. Do we want to do that? If we're not going to do that, and we say, oh, well, God declaring that light exists is it's an analogical way of expressing God creating the light, you know, using a human analogy. If we're going to do that with that, why can't we, you know, and if we have to do that sort of thing when it comes to Christ being begotten of the Father, it's analogical. It's not equivocal. It's not like it has nothing to do with human begetting. But it's, you know, it's not univocal, because if it were univocal, we'd have to be Arians. So we have to say that it's analogical because he's eternally begotten of the Father. Eternally being the Son of the Father, stemming from the Father. So why can't we simply take this understanding and then apply it to justification as well? You can't simply appeal to the lexicon and be like, well, the lexicon says what the lexicon says, when you already have to concede that you can't simply go with the bare denotation of terms in other contexts and in other areas of theology that are actually more clear cut in the history of Christianity and are actually, like, you know, points of agreement between Catholics and Protestants. You know, Catholics and Protestants, we also agree that we shouldn't be open theists. It's very enlightening for me to watch debates like, I think it was Bob Enhart. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing his last name, but he and James White had a debate about open theism, and and the open theist guy, he's going through the Bible and he's like used a highlighter and he's saying, see, here are all these passages that seem to attribute, you know, change to God, emotions to God, you know, And he says, well, we should take these at face value, even though that goes against the traditional omnis and ims, which he blames on Greek philosophy. Whereas I think exegetically speaking, I think James White did a better job of ultimately dealing with and reconciling the text. But I feel like they were, you know, going past each other to a large extent because they never really got into the fundamental hermeneutical question. Like the open theist guy could say, well, these omni and im type statements, we can interpret them a little differently in order to reconcile them with all these, you know, passages that seem to kind of anthropomorphize God. Whereas, you know, James White is saying, well, really ultimately his hermeneutic is to treat the omni and im statements as more primary. And then we have to then read all the anthropological stuff through kind of the lens of that, you know, pre-understanding of the text and, you know, a pre-understanding of the text, AKA tradition. Those kind of conversations are pretty enlightening in my opinion, because when the Protestant then goes to us and talks to us about justification solely in terms of like Dicaio and so forth, I think they're temporarily turning into an open theist, at least in that sense. There's overlap. And I think that that's fairly revealing. I think okay. If you're going to be consistent, you need to go the open theist route, or you need to pull back and go the Catholic / Orthodox route on this particular question. When it comes to, now there are other factors, I think, for Protestants that play a big role in why they want to go with more forensic understanding of justification. And I try to go to great lengths to understand that perspective. You have the perspective of total depravity, the idea that even before we talk about the constitution of man, the idea that you've done a sin that's on your legal track record, and that remains on your track record, that can't just, you know, be taken off by anything that you do. I mean, that part is obviously true.
Right.
But, you know, viewing justification as being primarily this legal thing that's going on, seemingly on a heavenly ledger or seemingly in the mind of God. I think there's a problem there with divine immutability. There's no change we can predicate of God. There's no change in God's mind. I know I disagree with Dr. Robertson Jenness on that one, because he's Catholic apologist. You're probably aware of him, but recently he's kind of come out more in favor of certain open theist type positions where he's denying divine immutability, denying divine impassibility, came out with a book really? About it. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. And at the end of the day, neither I nor many other people have the time to deal with every theological controversy.
Yeah.
Some things yeah, right. I'm going to kind of treat as, okay, that's kind of a done deal. Most of my apologetic experience and interactions have been with Protestants. And so I'm going to kind of start off with, okay, we have our omnis and our ims. We have our traditional attributes of God, traditional understanding. I'm going to go from that, go from our areas of common agreement into the areas where we seem to disagree and ask why. Okay. So you have the total depravity thing such that, well, if the sin of Adam is imputed to you from the Protestant perspective, it's legally attributed to you. Well, then nothing about you changes that unless your legal status is changing because the attribution is stopping. So, you know, sola fide is all about changing the legal situation with the sanctification, the redemption of, you know, your soul, mind, and body, your inner self. That aspect is, it's not that it's totally unimportant within a Protestant soteriology. It's not that it's sidelined, strictly speaking, but it is put into a very distinct second place. It's not what saves you. It's the result of what saves you. In the sense that justification is primary and that is what saves you, because the problem is your legal status. That's why you're going to go to hell. And therefore your legal status needs to be changed by something legal, a legal change.
Right. Which was Christ's death on the cross, right? In their view. Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you get to the, you know, and then aside from the imputation of the sin of Adam, there's the imputation of all your own sins from the Protestant mm-hmm. perspective. And they're like, look, in classical Protestant theology, there isn't really a venial mortal sin distinction. Lutheran theology, and I think to some extent Anglican and Methodist, has a bit more nuance. So I'm painting with somewhat of a broad brush, because, you know, they believe that, you know, the loss of faith can be kind of linked with particular sins, but they really think it's the loss of faith that is what's causing your loss of justification and your loss of salvation.
Right. Not
that
sins.
That's nuance that can be teased out. Right. But in the case of, you know, just all of Protestantism, it still remains the case that, you know, all sins in and of themselves, all sin is a breaking of the law. You break the law at all, you're not righteous, or you're not sufficiently righteous in order to merit heaven. It's kind of this idea that, well, within like later Protestantism, that there was this covenant, you know, this in Reformed theology, that there was this covenant of works that Adam was supposed to fulfill. He didn't. And not only is his failure to fulfill it imputed to us, but each of us can't fulfill it. You know, and that would require total perfection on our part. When I look at the Bible, I ultimately don't see this. The idea that the term right, if we went back for a second and just kind of tried to put ourselves in the shoes, or rather the sandals, of an ancient Israelite, an ancient Jew, and ask, how are they going to interpret all those references to righteousness in the Old Testament? Do they interpret all of them as just a legal attribution that God is giving to a person? Do they or do they not? I don't think that they do. I think they understood righteousness. I don't think they had the full-blown understanding of it that we have like later on in Christian theology. But do they have a fundamental understanding of righteousness as having to do with holiness, having to do with a virtue, having to do with behavior? Yes, I do. I think that that's the case. And I think you have to kind of go approach the Old Testament a bit eisegetically in order to read it otherwise. As you see, oh, Noah was a righteous man. And you're like, yep, that's because, you know, inherently he was totally depraved, but God happened to take Jesus' perfect righteousness, attribute it to Noah, and there, that's why Noah was righteous there. What Israelite, you know, what Jew could possibly understand the text that way for hundreds of years? Granting that there are parts of the Old Testament that are cryptic and cannot be fully understood until, you know, the onset of the, you know, the person and revelation of Jesus Christ, you know, and then the life of the apostles after. But to take something as fundamental as, oh, this person's righteous, this person is not, to take something as fundamental as that and to act like the Jews had no idea what it really meant way back when, I think that that's, you know, pretty problematic. So I don't think that that works. I don't think the idea that that all sin is mortal ultimately works. I understand why, you know, Protestants might say that. They can go to, was it Romans 6:23? The wages of sin is death. They can go to, I think, where it's James. I think James is the one where you're, you know, guilty of all. Paul talks along those lines as well. But I think, kind of taking those,
Sean,
in a very
you cut out there for a second, just like the, maybe 15 seconds
the
ago.
Reference in one point you've offended at all. So, yeah, I think we just had bad internet for a second. So the notion that like one little offense is equivalent to you like violating the entire law or violating so in a full blown condemnation worthy sense, particularly. With my seventh graders, we run through the Old Testament. We read like all of Genesis. We read a lot of Exodus. We went back and forth through different parts of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Part of my mentality is, you know, if I'm not doing this with you guys now, like who's ever going to do this with you? And I want you guys to have this kind of background, this kind of foundation. You might not remember all of it, but you'll remember a good amount of it, and you'll remember that I didn't just throw like little. You know, I didn't say, hey, memorize the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit, you know, which is important, right. But I think we do have to have a very strongly biblically rooted faith. You know, I don't grant that the evangelical that I run into, you know, should be the person who knows the Bible, you know, better. You know, so I try to kind of put that, you know, on my students' radar. Like I'll quote chapter and verse from memory of various things, and I try to be biblically immersed, and I just love it when I bring something up with my students and their hand goes up and they're like, this is like when that other thing happened. And I'm like, yes, it is. You remember. Good job. You look in the Old Testament, you look in the Mosaic Law, and it had what is effectively a typological prefigurement of the venial mortal sin distinction. You have your deadly sins and your undeadly sins. Numbers, I want to say Numbers 15. where you have, you know, some sins that just cut you off from the covenant. Either God strikes you down dead immediately, or the community is supposed to execute you. And you have other sins that, no, you just do some, you participate in the sacrifices and you're covered. What does that sound like to you? I think of Hebrews 10, where it talks about if we sin deliberately, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. That's just echoing that aspect of the Old Testament. 1 John 5, when you have the sin that is deadly, sin is not deadly. I don't think the, you know, Calvinist kind of reading that the deadly sin is just having a practice of sin ultimately meshes with what's being communicated there. I think we're very distinctly talking about a type of sin. The context of Hebrews 10 makes this, I think, pretty blatant as well. We're talking about a type of sin that someone who's a member of the covenant can perform. I also think the notion that you can be part of the covenant and not saved doesn't really work. Was it, I think, that's like a Presbyterian conceptualization, whereas the Baptists kind of agree with us insofar as they say, well, to be part of the new covenant means to be saved. And we're like, well, we agree with you. Whereas the Presbyterians are saying, well, no, there's a distinction. I think that distinction between being saved and being part of the covenant, that's an Old Testament thing. That distinction doesn't translate into the New Testament. At which point, you know, being part of the covenant, you know, is to be saved. So, yeah, you know, that plays a role. Now we're interpreting these typological connections. Right. You look at the fact that if you were like guilty of killing somebody, if it wasn't intentional, you know, homicide, if it wasn't like deliberate murder, then there are these six Israelite cities of refuge, Levitical cities that you could flee to, grasp the horns of the altar, and that was two particular instances where people did that with the altar of burnt offering. I don't know if they had a facsimile of that in these cities, but the point is they go to these cities run by the Levites who are offering sacrifice. And as long as they stay in those cities until the high priest dies, then they're covered. And this obviously has, you know, to some extent, you know, repercussions for Christian theology and Jesus Christ being our ultimate refuge, that we can go and we can appeal to him. Approaching the throne of grace is like grasping the horns of the altar. It's similarly with going up for communion. We think that that's how you approach the throne of grace. Hebrews 4, I want to say 4:16, I don't think it's 4:15. I think that's the he's without sin verse.
It'll get people in the ballpark no matter what.
Yeah. And then Hebrews 13:10, we have an altar that those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat from. The Eucharistic altar is where heaven and earth meet, and we can approach this. If we're doing it, you know, out of the state of grace, you know, it's like the person who's actually guilty, who tries to go to one of these cities of refuge you're not covered by the sacrifice of Christ in that instance, even if you might have been previously. That's the thing, even if you might have been previously. So I think that really poses serious problems for eternal security / perseverance of the saints, whether it's the more, you know, popular evangelical version or the more thought out reformed / Calvinist version.
Is there a particular strain of Protestantism that you kind of focus on in particular, or you just kind of like just take it as it comes?
To some extent take it as it comes. I feel like Calvinists, you know, / Reformed, I interact a fair amount with them, Lutherans a fair amount with them, and then your popular like non-denominational Baptists, you know, the ones who are, you know, effectively Baptists who don't want to call themselves Baptists.
Right.
It's like, okay, so what doctrines do you believe? Check. Okay. Baptist. I mean, I'm not going to beat you over the head with it and be rude if you don't want to be called that, but I'm between the two of us, I can say, you know, we got to call a spade. If you think that baptism is just a symbol, if you think that it is not to be given to infants, if your approach to all the sacraments is this demarcation, strict demarcation between symbol and reality, then, you're Baptistic in your thinking. Whereas if you go If you go to Reformed theology, that sharp divide is not quite as sharp. And if you go into Lutheranism, it's even less sharp. It's not really as much affecting the sacraments, because the sacramentology of Lutherans can be decently high from our perspective. Right. But the sticking point still becomes faith and works, faith and works, faith and works. Right. So right. We still have a thing there, but, I try to, kind of branch out and not only talk to like one particular kind of group. So to a large extent, I do kind of take it as it comes.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that because you can't anticipate all of the variety that's there, right? You have to
not always. It's to me, it's very interesting that to some extent you can on certain types of questions. And sometimes when you're talking to someone, you can get a sense of their epistemology, you can get a sense of their hermeneutic, and then not that you should be constantly assuming, but then you're in a position where you're not necessarily surprised when you learn their view on a particular issue, of doctrine.
Sure, because you can kind of see it coming if you
at that point you kind of can. It doesn't mean you should make assumptions and accuse them of something they haven't articulated yet, but it does mean that you can kind of prepare yourself and know what you're getting into.
Right, and especially understanding where they're coming from epistemologically, how they think, is incredibly helpful. Yeah, mm-hmm. I would say. Yeah, so, okay. I hear a lot of Catholics throw this around, and I've thrown it around myself. But the link between Protestantism in particular and modern philosophy or modern society, would you want to riff on that a little bit?
Sure.
And maybe tell us where that's a true thing and where it's maybe not so true.
I think an area where it's maybe not so true, that there's a reactionary thing going on here, so it's less derivative. But so you have the Reformation and kind of opposing faith and reason in a way that Catholic tradition didn't want to do. But granting that there were elements within Catholic tradition that had started to do this during the Via Moderna. So the Reformation kind of piggybacked off of that. It's not like the Reformation came out of thin air. But so this, opposition between faith and reason, well, the Reformation kind of sides more with the faith side. I think that they try to pull themselves back and give more, credence, more respect to reason as Reformation goes on. Luther, I think in particular, was just, if he didn't like something, he did things like call reason a whore and so forth.
Sure. I've heard Lutheran pastors themselves like acknowledge that kind of
he was willing to use reason to the point where reason no longer aligned with his starting positions. So, which I think later Protestantism was trying to pull itself back from. And with any movement historically, you're going to see ping-ponging back and forth. You just are. There's a pendulum, just as there is in politics.
In Catholicism, it happens, happens everywhere. Yeah.
You got it. So you have that going on. Then you have the Enlightenment show up. And partly as a result of things like the 30 Years' War, all those wars of religion, what's the saying, people arguing over how many angels dance on the head of a pin. And from a practical perspective, a lot of people, I think, in Europe started to think, why are we fighting and dying over certain things? That it seems like, that especially as Christianity was becoming more diverse, it's like, well, how can I even know which answer on this is right? Even the sola scriptura people well, sure, I'm going by the Bible alone, but those other five people are going by the Bible alone and none of us agree. There's always going to be epistemological issues when it comes to human understanding of ancient texts. So I think, the Enlightenment shows up and they're kind of, going back into more of an emphasis on reason. And then as the Enlightenment's going on, they're kind of like, oh, this faith thing. Yeah. Let's just, we don't need that. Or don't need that as much. Even though, anytime you have a priori positions, in a sense, those are those can be construed as faith claims. It really, really depends.
On
how you understand. On how you understand a priority positions. Are they
right?
Are they knowable by human reason? Are they inborn? Are they something you learn through your senses, or are they something that's kind of implanted? Given that we didn't have too many atheists yet, we more had kind of people going the deist route. You know, God creates the universe and steps back. So I think,
and everybody makes a priori assumptions at the beginnings of their worldview. You know, like
I think you're just assuming that.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah,
yep. So, I think the Enlightenment's kind of the pendulum swinging, and then they're focusing very much on reason. And this is why I think like documents like JP2's Fides et Ratio, like Faith and Reason, I think that's very important. I think any other Christian group has to kind of go for that same synthesis, even though they might not come to all the same conclusions as us. It's very important that, you know, every Christian group does go in that direction. The number of times I see certain evangelical types, you present to them a logical syllogism with a conclusion that follows from the premises, and they're just like, no, the conclusion cannot be true. And at that point, that's just fideism. You know, and then you have other people that are like, well, unless you can, you know, absolutely deductively prove something to me, then I'm not going to believe it. Well, that's, you know, then you're going the rationalist route. And like I tell my students, we want to avoid fideism. You know, we want, you know, only relying on faith. We want to avoid rationalism, only relying on reason. We need to have a synthesis.
And they're both extremes are reactions to each other.
Absolutely. It becomes the chicken and the egg thing when you kind of need both the chicken and the egg. You know, and then you get the empiricism, just overly relying on sense experience when we know that that's not the only way we learn things or know things.
It seems like I don't know if you've noticed this, but it seems that lately empiricism has kind of waned
actually. I think because it has certain limitations. You can't derive moral precepts and norms solely from empiricism. I think was it Hume's idea? You can't derive an ought from an is. So you can't get like something is moral to do or not solely because, oh, we've looked at the genome and, you know, we understand the human brain so much more. Well, that's great. Great that you understand the brain. That doesn't translate into I must act a certain way towards other people. It doesn't. It translates into you can explain like why people will react certain ways based on how I treat them. That does not in any way provide the ought. And modern secularism is fairly dogmatic about the ought. They care an awful lot about the ought, especially as it translates into public policy. It's not just about, you know, being in your ivory tower making truth claims. It's about practical reality, boots on the ground. And then you have to be able to do ought type things. And you have to be, you know, so you have to have a certain degree of moral absolutism. Like from the new atheists, you see a fair amount of moral absolutism. You know, people like Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, you saw a lot of that. And I think a lot of it was kind of carried by his rhetoric and to some extent misconceptions. But to some extent, the new atheists were responding to modern fundamentalism. Anytime I hear their depiction of God, I'm like, okay, that sounds like Zeus. That does not sound like the classical, you know, Catholic, Orthodox, and even classical Protestant, like more transcendent Trinitarian God.
A non-anthropomorphized or physicalized God. Like they would always throw out the flying spaghetti monster, right?
Yeah. That's what and they so, to a large extent, they're having their conversation with the wrong people. Dr. Brian Cross had a great article about this a while back on, Christopher Hitchens and Doug Wilson. And it was about how the two of them are both kind of skeptics about the role of reason, in a sense, and such that they don't have reason in the natural law as like a bridge, for them to, really come to terms. Hitchens coming at things from kind of a morally dogmatic, anti-religious, like skeptic position, and Doug Wilson coming at things from a presuppositionalist Christian, you know, Calvinist. He's Calvinist, isn't he? I want to say he's Calvinist.
I don't know, to be honest. I'm not gonna
die on that hill. I think he leans in that direction. Him, you know, the more kind of fideist type of position at the end of the day.
And then you see people like Sam Harris, who, you know, as of late has become, it seems, much more of a realist in certain ways. He's like,
I was going to bring him up. Sam Harris kind of took Dawkins and company and took them like really having kind of a very vacuous philosophical understanding of how to defend their, you know, their cafeteria Western civilization approach, where they're just like, well, these values we really like, and they seem to contribute to human happiness, and this matters because and Sam Harris wants to do more of, you know, I want to provide an objective grounds for morality and so forth. He doesn't want to, you know, base it on divine will, obviously, but he wants to base it on something other than we have a majority of people happen to like X. That's not good enough. That's good enough if you simply want to convince the public to support certain things because you want those certain things to happen, either for yourself or because you have certain values, certain, you know, beliefs and so forth. But I do give Sam Harris credit in that he does seem more interested in that philosophical dimension. The impression I get is he is moving kind of more that way. I guess with somebody like him, I'd want to try and convince them to go like a realist, like Platonist, Neoplatonist route.
Yes, you know, Aristotelian route.
I would not sit down with Sam Harris with a Bible.
No,
I nitpicked like a very specific thing that I knew he wouldn't have a problem with, but I know from my experiences that like he would, you know, someone like him, you know, many others would like immediately be like, well, okay, but this, you know, because it's like this wariness that they know that, you know, the camel's nose of Christianity, once that gets in, the rest is going to come in. So I would honestly not start off with, you know, anything other than just reason. I would start off with that. And I'd be like, oh, you're a moral absolutist. Great.
Yeah,
great.
Exactly.
You're not a relativist. Exactly. You're not a subjectivist. You're not a nihilist.
Your worldview actually makes somewhere. Sense.
We have a starting point. Let's start with that starting point and work out from there. And maybe we can come to some consensus on a number of things.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I think that you see it with people like Jordan Peterson too. I know he's kind of becoming more Christian, but like you see this sort of movement, this secular movement towards realism, which is really beautiful. Like people are actually, they're kind of recovering from the nihilism and the nominalism of the last 200 or 300 years.
And you would ask me about that. So I talk about one aspect. Let me get to the other aspect real quick. So I do think I'm blanking on the name of the book. But there was a book written about Protestantism and kind of how it had, you know, somewhat disastrous effects on modern civilization. It was like Brad Gregory or someone along those lines wrote a book about this. And I have it on my shelf. I have not had a chance to read it yet. So I don't wish to, you know, put my foot in my mouth and attributing things to him that he wasn't necessarily saying. But the impression I get is, and this is from other stuff I've read too, that I have read. I still got, as I said, I still got to read that book. The nominalism that kind of pervaded the Reformation, like did kind of, you know, lead to, there are certain elements where it did kind of agree with Enlightenment thought, like the, you know, hermeneutics of skepticism and more exactitude and less appreciation of nuance in the communication of truths. And I think that we've had effects across the board, societally, philosophically, know, we're seeing it. I really do feel that like 1800s onward, we're really seeing a lot of Protestant positions and the ramifications of them for us in Western civilization, even, you know, by people who are only nominally Christian anymore, you know, the moral therapeutic right. deists. The notion, for example, in the 1800s, we have, you know, kind of the onset of, for women, the idea that women should have, you know, more rights respected and should be more so treated as equals, which is awesome and wonderful. But that kind of put alongside this egalitarian notion that men and women are effectively interchangeable.
It kind of opened.
If you accept right. the notion of imputed righteousness and that, like, you know, take things like that YouTube video about the Goodometer where Jesus steps on a scale in place of everyone and it keeps saying perfect. Like,
I've never seen that. Okay.
I'll have to send you the link for it. If everyone's just kind of given Jesus's legal status, it's like, well then, yeah, we are kind of interchangeable at that point. Beyond the point where like a kind of distinction between ontology and accidents would really nail that better. So, you know, so in the 1800s, you kind of have this growing attitude of men and women are fundamentally, you know, indistinguishable apart from, you know, hardware differences. And once you're going that route, how can you not eventually get to a point of yes to female ordination, yes to same-sex marriage? How can you not get to that point? And then furthermore, with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, you know, you get, you know, the switch from rural society to more urban society, and you get, you know, socioeconomic changes. Children go from economic asset on your farm to economic liability for most people. Right. Surprise, surprise, everyone reworks the notion that artificial contraception is a no-go. And that further degrades the idea of male-female complementarity and, again, puts us in a position where, well, sex is an intimate sexual act between two people who love each other. That's become our new societal definition that is presently fighting the idea of sex as being, you know, like going and playing a game of catch. Where people are treating it like very frivolously, whereas other people still want to harp on like, no, it's for two people who love each other. So they at least right. got that aspect right.
Right.
You know, there's always a continuum of truth and error. But so we really can understand, I think, you know, societally, and especially with the nominalism undercurrent, if we're not having a strong focus on belief in natures and so forth, I mean, that's how you can have a conversation with someone and you say, well, this isn't natural. And they're like, well, animals are having,
yes,
you know, homosexual relations. And it's like, well, we're not, exactly. when we say natural, we don't mean not simply naturally occurring, but that's the only place where your mind goes, because you don't have a sense of there is this realm of the natural that we are below and fallen from, and that, you know, that everything is supposed to accord with that. The idea that even right. medicine, like, what's the point of medicine? To restore or fix nature? To, you know, the idea that we don't take the baby who's born without like several fingers and say, well, that's just a variation like hair color. We say, well, that's a defect, that's a problem. And to the, you know, these are things that we want to try and address. And we're kind of moving into territory where everyone's in an ether, like moving around, not knowing where to go next, because we've removed so much of the philosophical bedrock and theological bedrock upon which so much of society and society's values and legal structures was based. So
right.
how can we not be at a point where someone says, well, I identify as X, all of you should, you know, recognize that, or you're oppressing me? Because other cases where things weren't being recognized, people were being oppressed, and people don't know where to draw the line. It's one thing to tell a white person and a black person, you two aren't married because I have, you know, negative racist views about minorities. Well, we can, through reason and revelation, nix that one we can't, through reason and revelation, argue in favor of same-sex relationships or argue in favor of treating gender dysphoria as like your personal revelation of the truth. We have to, at the end of the day, call a spade, and we have to do it in as charitable of a manner as possible.
Right.
I certainly think that we need to do that. We need to, you know, hold off to the mockery as best we can, hold off of it, and try to meet people where they are and have reasonable discussions and conversations. But I understand how we got to where we are. And to me, it's obvious how to get out of it. Try to shift our secular culture to be more philosophically realist.
Yep, exactly.
And
yeah.
Within our church, stop watering down the truth and, you know, focus on speaking the truth in charity and prudence. Kind of clean up shop within the church itself so we can be a better witness to the other forms of Christianity, because I do think a unified Christianity under, you know, the flag of Catholicism is going to be much better able to deal with the challenge of modern secularism. I think if you went back to the time of the war on terror and whatnot, a lot of people were starting to get fearful and thinking, well, is, you know, radical Islam is going to be the next major threat in the world today. And it was, historically speaking, I think we're going to find there was really more of a blip than anything else. I think modern secularism is much more insidious, much more dangerous than any threat posed by Islam. And so a unified Christianity needs to respond to that, because it denigrates from Christianity's witness when we're so diversified, because we then come across as, well, we can't even agree with each other. So how can we possibly, you know, preach the gospel to you? Because you're like, how do you, which gospel? How do you know which gospel is right?
Yep. Exactly.
So I think the fractionization of Christianity through increasing denominations, I'm not going to repeat the tired 40,000 statistic. I recognize that that's in part based on distinctions that are not true denominational distinctions. For me, it's less about the number and it's more about the fact that what makes a denomination is a group of people who have different sets of doctrines.
Right.
That is primarily, you know, what I'm thinking about.
And two of those is a problem, not to mention hundreds.
Right. Yeah, having two denominations, we already get a problem. But like, can any Protestant seriously argue that we don't have at least like a dozen denominations? And we have a number of denominations out there, and we can look back historically and be like, well, where did this come from? You had a person who, in addition to various pre-understandings the person had, and, you know, looking at the text and, you know, as with any text, coming to different interpretations of it, had a problem. Or person who developed a new religious tradition. And some of these have a better historical pedigree than others. Some are just brand spanking new. And are we just saying Christianity is around 2,000 years old? Or are we going to say that, well, whatever version of Christianity is correct should be that old, should be continuously evidenced throughout history? I do feel to some extent that even the more high-end Protestant scholars and so forth have to kind of take pot shots at our narrative for history. I don't think they're able to come up with a compelling narrative for church history that would give us reason to be like, oh, Protestantism must be, you know, one of the versions of Protestantism must be the right one.
Sure. So yeah, I think that they can blow a few holes in it and show inconsistencies at times, but I don't think they can offer much in return.
There are those who try, and I appreciate what they're doing in the same, but at the same time, I also kind of appreciate what the non-denominationals who say, well, let's just focus on the Bible are kind of doing, because Sola Scriptura does at a certain point kind of lean that way. I know, was it Keith Matheson's book, The Shape of Sola Scriptura? He draws a distinction between Solo Scriptura and Sola Scriptura.
Right.
Solo being just, you know, me and my Bible, whereas sola would be I'm allowed to use other sources to inform my understanding of the text.
Right. Which is the latter one of those is much more of a magisterial Protestant.
Sure. View, oh, absolutely.
You know, a classical Protestant view.
Absolutely. Right. But it still raises particular questions. And I think the folks at the Catholic blog Call to Communion have raised that in response to to Mr. Matheson, Dr. Mm-hmm. Matheson. I don't know if he has a doctor or not. I've only ever heard him referred to as Keith Matheson. Anyway, so they were basically saying, well, all those other things that you're looking at other than scripture, you're allowing them to inform your view of scripture, but to what extent do you accept those things or not as having true weight? Because at a certain point, you're filtering those other things and you accepting them or not through the way you view scripture. So it's certainly, it is different than solo scriptura, but is it different enough that we want to say that it's like truly fundamentally distinct? And that I don't know so much about. I kind of okay. think not.
Okay.
So
interesting.
Yeah. So I think, if you're going to allow other things to have consultative value for how you understand scripture, for how you're reading scripture, well, who gets to decide which things get to have consultative value and what's going to be your barometer for how you're going to, adjudicate those questions?
Right.
Like, are you going to allow Nicaea? Because if you look at the canons of Nicaea, it's clear. And also you look at the people who are participating in Constantinople I, when they're talking about baptism, and then when they're later in 381 at Constantinople I talking about baptism for the forgiveness of sins, do they mean symbol only? Do they mean something that is at least open-ended enough to be open to a Baptist interpretation? I don't think they do at all. So I think any Baptist who's saying the Nicene-Constantinopolitan Creed is engaging in, anachronism if they're saying it and right. meaning what they think about baptism when they're saying it. So, right. So we have our group of Protestants who are trying to create a narrative based on the available sources that's more compatible with, historic Protestantism, typically magisterial Protestantism. And then you have the folks that just kind of give up on the history side of it. On the one hand, yeah. I think the folks giving up on the history side of it, I think they're kind of onto something in that fundamentally Protestantism, you have to at a certain point be like, well, if we don't have historical continuity, if there seems to be a huge gap of time where there's no Protestant doctrines or a lot of my particular ones aren't found, that's not a problem. At a certain point, every Protestant has to kind of take that position. It's just the evangelical low church types kind of just own that sooner. Whereas the more magisterial types, they have, like you and I, they have a bit more respect for history and historical continuity. And so for them, they're like, well, sure, at the end of the day, what scriptural matters and this other stuff doesn't matter on that level, but it still matters a lot. And it should at least cause us to be skeptical of claims that something is scriptural. I just don't think that their explanations when they're trying to interpret the church fathers and so forth are ultimately mm-hmm. compelling. I've coined an expression for this that I think is particularly poignant. I call it exporting perspicuity. And what do I mean by that? So as you know, perspicuity is the notion that scripture is clear. And there's different iterations of this. So you right. have the low church fundamentalist who's like, oh, well, scripture's clear. I can just pick it up. I totally understand it. You have a continuum of understanding where some people are like, well, some parts are hard to understand. Other parts are easy to understand. Use the easy parts to interpret the hard. I mean, that's Augustine's position. And that's a Catholic
right. position.
Nothing wrong with that notion. But the idea that notion is a sufficient hermeneutic for the whole Bible, that would not really be a Catholic notion. Especially if you look at Augustine's On Christian Doctrine, he uses several other criterion, like the criterion of charity and the criterion of the regula fide, the rule of faith, the church's teaching over time. That's part of Augustine's calculations as well. You have ultimately this continuum of understanding going on. When it comes to perspicuity, take the fact that at a certain point when you're discussing justification with most Protestants, you ultimately go to Romans and you ultimately go to how they think certain Pauline expressions have to mean certain things. And
right.
So what clued me into exporting perspicuity is that I just had a number of instances of reading things or having conversations with people where they took a patristic expression that sounded Pauline and they insisted the patristic expression meant what they think Paul meant. And to me, that's exporting perspicuity because you're acting like the father must have meant X because you think Paul meant X and the father sounds an awful lot like Paul in this particular instance. And it's like, if we then look at that father, and the nice thing about the fathers is many of them wrote a lot more than individual biblical writers did. You know, we can find more writings from Augustine than we can from Paul. And so we can get a better idea of what Paul thought just from an easiness perspective. So we're looking at all the Augustinian writings. It's like, okay, yeah, here are all these times where he's using Pauline language to talk about justification. We can either take those texts somewhat superficially and be like, ah, here we go. See, he believes in sola fide. Well, no, he doesn't. He's simply, in this case, he's just quoting from Romans. And you're going to assume that anyone who quotes Romans automatically agrees with your understanding of Paul. It kind of exposes that at a certain point, perspicuity is less about the Bible and more about human language and more about it. You know, certain verbal expressions you think are only capable of having a basically univocal and clear meaning to anyone reading them, such that if someone reads them differently, they're just being dishonest about the text.
It doesn't take in the hermeneutical value of reading. Yeah. Especially in ancient text. Mm-hmm. Right?
I love to bring up this one example from St. Augustine. So when he's evaluating Pelagius initially, he reads Pelagius's On Nature, De Natura, and he's like, oh yeah, Pelagius, he's saying that grace saves. Awesome. And Augustine is like, okay, I'm ready to vindicate this guy. And he's like, but I kept reading. He kept reading and realized that Pelagius was defining the term grace as having to do with human will, endowed with an unsullied free will, without any sanctifying grace infusing it, and that, you know, and great, and maybe grace also refers to like external helps, like the Ten Commandments and so forth. But like he realized that the way Pelagius was defining grace meant that even if he previously thought Pelagius was saying the same thing he was saying, he wasn't. That there was an entire synod in Palestine at the time, the Synod of Decapolis, that exonerated Pelagius. And Augustine writes about the proceedings, and it's like they thought Pelagius was innocent of what his actual position was because they looked at the formulations he used and kind of just let it end there and didn't keep reading. So any Protestant who takes the church fathers, in my opinion, and thinks that they held to like sola fide based solely on this exporting perspicuity methodology, they just need to keep reading. And they need to understand, you know, in my opinion, more deeply where the church fathers are coming from and what they mean by what they say, such that, no, you can't just take these expressions univocally. That's like the way that I think all of classical Protestantism, in a way, like when scripture talks about men justifying men, they're like, okay, means the same thing when God's justifying men, higher authority, but it's like it means the same thing. It's the same fundamental action going on. Well, hold the phone. No, it doesn't. Or at least you can't assume that it does. And we need to have a deeper conversation of about the why for that. So, that's kind of my attitude on when it comes to, you know, the battles we can have over the church fathers. In addition to trying to poke holes in our narrative, I think many Protestants will try to claim church fathers for themselves. You see those lists of copy-pasted patristic quotes online, really. Look, this church father held to sola fide. This church father held to eternal security. It's like, and then you look more in depth and you're like, no, they didn't. The number of times I've seen Calvinists in particular think Augustine held to eternal security when he didn't, they're totally misunderstanding what he says about predestination, what he says about the gift of final perseverance. For Augustine, yeah, he does talk about that the elect are all going to persevere to the end, right? But there are two things he doesn't say, and two things he actually says plenty of things that refute. He never says that the reprobate will never be justified. He uses the example of two pious men, one justified in baptism, the other justified in baptism, one who perseveres and one who doesn't. in his book on predestination. Very, very blatant. Anytime I show that quote to people, I've had some people kind of table pound and say it doesn't mean what I think it means without giving a counter exegesis. Or people will then try to argue that, well, Augustine's inconsistent. Well, sure. you didn't show me the evidence that he ever held an eternal security, so you're not showing any inconsistency, even really a supportive one.
And that does bring up a good point about, you know, when we look at the fathers or anybody throughout history, like somebody does have to acknowledge that the person's views may have changed over time. That is a reality, true too. Right? Like, and, sure. and so true too. you may be able to, you know, grasp one thing from one work that somebody made, but then not realize that, oh, they changed their mind on that topic later.
Yeah. Sometimes that does happen.
Right.
So, the approach of difficult. Really any of the church fathers, you have to go a lot more in depth beyond kind of the pop apologetics level that, you know, sometimes Catholics engage in and sometimes Protestants engage in and sometimes Orthodox engage in, and you need to delve deeper. But I think even before you delve deeper, because I don't think God is ultimately telling all of us, you need to become a patristic scholar in order to know which church to join. I don't think you have to become a biblical scholar to know which church to join. I think at the end of the day that's kind of also like a wrong-headed approach. There's a lot of people who bounce back and forth from denomination to denomination to denomination because they're trying to do it all on their own intellectually. And I don't think it's God meant for it to be that hard to figure out the truth. This is an area where I can kind of give a concession of a sort to, you know, the more low church evangelical types where they're like, this all seems so complicated. And I'm like, okay, I grant that. God does not want this to be so complicated that you have to become a scholar after like 20 years before you can finally figure out which church you're supposed to be part of, you know, before you can finally know the truth. I do think that Catholicism offers a more satisfying answer regarding this type of particular question than Protestantism can, because I think to some extent in Protestantism, you do kind of, you know, maybe not for a relationship with God, but at least to know that, hey, I'm in the body that is closest to the truth. You do have to do a lot of legwork to get there. And especially when we factor in that we're born into our denominations in the vast majority. You know, most Protestants do not learn what their beliefs are like by opening up a Bible. They, you know, learn from mommy and daddy and their pastor the same way that I did the same, you know. That's how most people start off with what religion they are. Now we shouldn't just simply hold on to that, but like, that's a starting point. I don't think ultimately finding the true church should be super complicated alongside that. I don't think it should be super complicated. I think it should be nuanced. I think it should develop and become more complex of a question, in terms of, you know, investigation and whatnot over time, but what do I care about? I care about being in Christ's church right now. And I think God made it insanely difficult in order for that to happen. I think things like the Reformation have made that more difficult than it needs to be.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, Sean, so yeah, we're going to have to wrap up here, but I have like probably 10 other questions I wish I could ask you. So maybe we can schedule another interview. But
for the sake of curiosity, you want to throw one more question my way, and when we'll kind of end with that one?
Yeah, sure. Inter Catholic debates. Do you have any thoughts on that briefly?
Not too many. I have a lot of thoughts, but not too many definitive, you know, declarations I'd want to make. We do, you know, especially these days, we have a lot of, you know, I talk about how Christianity needs to be unified. Well, we also need Catholicism to be unified. In the past, it was kind of more like the liberal cafeteria Catholic types. It was like, they were the ones that, you know, the conservative Catholics, like we were having the kind of back and forth with them. But now, you know, we see more kind of gulfs on the more conservative, you know, seemingly Orthodox side of the fence. You know, fights over Vatican II, fights over the Latin Mass versus the Novus Ordo. Very, very briefly, I accept Vatican II and don't have a problem with it. I do have a problem with its implementation in a number of respects. With regards to the liturgy, I feel that going after the Latin Mass to go after a smaller number of traditionalists who are like rad trads, that I think is like using a grenade to go after an anthill. So I think that, you know, that is imprudent, to put it delicately. We have bigger fish to fry. So I think that the people who want to attend the Latin Mass, you know, to the extent that is reasonable, that should be made available. Latin is still the church's like official liturgical language. And it's important, given all the semantic and confusion and so forth over church history, where a word would get translated and people would take it a totally different way. Maybe the wrong word was used for translation, plays a big role in Eastern Orthodox and Catholic disputes. Where there were times we were arguing about things like icons or the filioque, and we weren't even understanding what one another was saying.
Yeah, right.
So I think maintaining a, you know, Latin as the church's liturgical language and keeping a liturgy that's like the church's main liturgy, I think has a lot of value to it. Do I have a, you know, I primarily attend the Novus Ordo. I don't have a problem with it insofar as I don't think the Novus Ordo itself really becomes the problem. I think individual pastors, you know, individual priests doing mass and their bishops could definitely find ways to implement it better. I think that there's certain things that we could kind of carry over, as in, I don't see any reason why for reception of communion in the Novus Ordo, we couldn't switch to using, you know, altar rail. You know, kneel at an altar rail, that would help with the reverence question. I'm not a big communion in the hand is evil, only receive on the tongue person. I've switched to receiving on the tongue, in part because I don't like the circumstances associated with how we ended up with reception of the hand being regularly available. Cause it just came across as like, oh, all these people were disobeying. Well, you know, you're now allowed to do it. Right. You're now allowed to do it. I something about that I don't like. And I do think that there's a certain degree of passivity involved in reception of the tongue that just, you know, at the end of the day, to me, it's like baptism via immersion versus effusion, pouring. Like, I think both are legitimate. Both have different symbolic meaning. The same thing with which way the priest is facing. I see a lot of value to the priest, you know, facing up at the high altar, facing the east. There's something to be said for that. I also see value to the priest facing the people. I do not personally think Jesus was facing away from the apostles at the, at the Last Supper. But again, I don't have that big of a dog in the fight. I think we should just view each expression as being just one thing along in all the diversity of things that we can do that can be okay, that bishops exercising pastoral prudence can be like, well, if it seems like a huge chunk of my church-going population is no longer believing in things like the real presence, maybe we need to put some things in place that will better foster that.
Right.
You know, and maybe some things will work better than others. And, you know, again, as I told you much earlier on, I'm not a manager. Don't want to be. I don't want to be the administrative guy. I'd rather, you know, educate and talk, have discussions, and let other people do the managerial hard lifting. So I think we just have to pray that the Pope, that our bishops and our priests, on all these questions, do things a little bit, you know, better than they have in the past, and continue to try and keep that keep the body of Christ healthy and thriving, and to deal with problems as they come. Not going to delve into this right now, but I do think that the issue we're having with the various bishops and clergy in Germany right now, to me, that should be the Pope's main concern right now.
Yes.
That absolutely should be the main concern right now. Really nothing else. Except maybe, you know, finalizing, cleaning up the clergy sex abuse scandal type stuff. They simply need to put very drastic, rigorous rules in place that you're looking at a lifetime of penance. You're looking at mandatory reporting under pain of excommunication. You're looking at, you know, mandatory requirements that any clergy who are in present with a child, there must be another adult, another adult who is not working for the priest and cannot receive any, you know, negative repercussions from the priest for reporting anything. Like, you need to have all that stuff put in place and rigidly enforced, so that even as more skeletons are going to keep coming out of the closet regarding what's happened in the last like 50, 60 years or so, to make sure that there aren't any more and to protect our children.
Right. Precisely. Awesome. Okay. Well, Sean, do you have anything you want to promote for yourself? Do you have...
Give me one second. And because I do think I have one thing I'd like to promote. Give me one second.
Yeah.
One of my friends, she makes and sells her own rosaries. Let me actually go grab mine. I want to show it to you. I'm definitely going to give her a shout out right now.
No problem.
Okay. Should have thought about this in advance. But so she made me this beautiful rosary.
Oh, wonderful. Got
some holy water there. And I think it's just great. And so she we got the fish going on over there. So it's just beautiful. And I'm trying to find her the name. But I definitely like to promote her rosaries. It's Luxury Rosaries by Kimberly. Let me pull up the link for that.
I'll post that link in the show notes.
Yeah, might need to update the link for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you can always send it to me after we're done recording here.
Sure. I was hoping to get it in the video itself. Luxury Rosaries by Kimberly. Her name's Kimberly Jones. Very awesome woman. Faith-filled convert to Catholicism. And
awesome.
Yeah, from the Jehovah's Witnesses, and she's you know, in the bosom of the church now, and she has two wonderful, wonderful, wonderful kids, and awesome. Yeah, very faithful woman, and anything to help her out, I'd love to be part of, and definitely doing anything to improve her rosary sales, I think more Catholics need to pray the rosary. I know that I did.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Awesome. And then anywhere where people can find you and your work?
I'm on Facebook as Sean Hutton, and there's only so many Sean Huttons. A couple of years back, I looked up as many other Sean Huttons as I could, and I'm like friending them all. I'm like, this is hilarious. I have to. my apologetics is mostly on Facebook thus far. I've been contemplating making my own YouTube channel. And jumping into that, I just haven't done that yet. The life of a middle school teacher, hard to do a lot of other stuff.
Right.
So, there's that.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sean. And hopefully we'll be able to talk again soon.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. Take care and God bless.